You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, and welcome to a new series of the Hayek Program Podcast, Women in Policy. I'm your host, Jessica Kargis, and this series is focused on interviews with women who work on policy-relevant research, specifically on topics which directly impact women. Now, any policy that impacts human beings will in some way impact women, but I've curated a series of guests whose research is particularly and hopefully obviously relevant to women. Our guest today is Dr. Deanna Thomas. Deanna was born and raised just outside of Cologne in Germany. Dr. Thomas earned her diploma in business administration from FH Aachen and a BS in finance from George Mason University in 2004. After gaining some experience as a junior portfolio manager at Alliance Global Investors in Frankfurt, Germany, she returned to George Mason University to complete her PhD in economics in 2009. Deanna's research explores the unintended consequences of regulation and the role political entrepreneurs play in changing the rules that govern a society. She is a professor of economics at the Hyder College of Business at Creighton University, an associated editor of the Journal of Private Enterprise, North American editor of the Review of Austrian Economics, and one of the co-editors of the Independent Review. Dr. Thomas is also an alumni of the Mercatus Center's PhD Fellowship Program. Deanna has previously been a guest on the Hayek Program podcast, where she discussed the regressive effects of regulation and liberalism with Hayek scholar Jamie Lemke. For context, these are regulations that are designed to protect the most vulnerable, but end up imposing significant costs on those who can least afford to bear them. If you're interested in this topic more broadly, I highly recommend giving that episode a listen. And to help you find it, it was posted on June 15th, 2022. Today, we are focusing specifically on understanding why the cost of childcare is so high and the regressive effects of regulation in the market for childcare. This is a topic Deanna has published on many times, including in 2014 in the Journal of Regulatory Studies, and again more recently in her 2022 article, The Impact of the Coronavirus Pandemic on the Market for Childcare, which appeared in the Journal of Entrepreneurship and Public Policy. So Dr. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What inspired you to research the market for childcare, and what motivates this research?
Yeah, so I had originally been invited to contribute a chapter on childcare to a report that Roger Koppel was putting together for the National Center for Policy Analysis. That was back in 2011. That report kind of focused on lowering regulatory barriers for entrepreneurs who were providing services for low-income households in particular. So it was protection services, policing, jitneys, and childcare was one of the topics that was the one that I worked on. And that was the first time that I looked into childcare regulation in the United States in greater detail. I really didn't know very much about it at all before then. But the year after that, I had my first child, and she attended a childcare center at Utah State University. And that was the first time that I encountered the effects of some of those regulatory rules in person. Some that stood out in particular were just rules about how many staff there had to be for every infant that they were caring for. And also, rules about how long you could use your pumped breast milk after you had pumped it. And, you know, things like that, that made the life of a new mother a little bit more complicated. But yeah, so that's kind of how I got interested in the topic.
Got it. So just to provide some context, is childcare actually that expensive? What are the cost trends in the market for childcare, and just how expensive actually is it?
Yeah, so the average price of childcare across all states and age groups in 2023 was roughly $11,000. So people sometimes compare the cost of early childhood education to the cost of college. And a lot of times people do that to exaggerate the cost of care or the claims about the cost of childcare. But it turns out they're actually not that far off. I think the average cost of in-state tuition at a public university last year in 2023 was right around $10,000. So obviously, you know, college has a higher peak there for the prices, but the average costs are right around the same for public institutions. Now, over the last few years, the average price of childcare has increased roughly with inflation every year. So it's not quite like college, the cost of college in that sense. In 2020 and 2021, there was a greater increase in the cost of childcare by about 5% each year, and exceeded inflation in those 2 years. And the price also varies quite a bit by state. So for example, in Washington, D.C. and in Massachusetts, those are the two states with the highest prices. The cost of childcare was on average $25,000 and $24,000 for infant care, and then $20,000 in D.C. and $18,000 in Massachusetts for four-year-old care in 2023. Now, at the lower end, are states like South Dakota and Mississippi, and there the cost of infant care was right around $8,000 and $7,000 for four-year-old care.
Oh, wow. Got it. So someone that lives in the Washington, D.C. area, like myself, if I had a child and needed daycare, I'm spending almost or at least $2,000 a month on that care, which is quite similar to almost paying rent or like a mortgage payment. It's not that far off. So childcare is particularly expensive in some areas and still a significant cost, even in states where it is more affordable. I liked that comparison to college tuition. It's maybe not so extreme in how high it can go, but it is comparable in how large of an expense it is. So who is most impacted by these high childcare costs?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously families who have to pay for out-of-home care when both parents are employed and who don't have relatives that live nearby or anything like that are going to be the ones that are most affected by this. You know, at the most basic level, if you're thinking about a family with two working parents and no help from relatives, they're going to have to decide, you know, if it makes sense to send their child to a daycare center or if for one of the parents to kind of step away from employment to stay home with the child. And depending on which spouse is the higher income earner, this will affect either the mother or the father. But in reality, for most families, the calculus is a little bit more complicated. So as I already mentioned, right, some families are able to rely on relatives and friends for care, which can reduce the cost of childcare. Sometimes spouses are able to divide up childcare responsibilities so that both parents can work full time. This will obviously depend on them having kind of offsetting schedules somehow, or both having flexible work schedules. Single parents face probably the most difficult scenario on the whole, because they don't have anybody that they can trade off with in terms of a spouse. And it seems that on net, mothers still do the majority of childcare. We kind of saw that during the pandemic a little bit, albeit with a lot of help from fathers, right? So if you're looking kind of across the spectrum, and the data here is kind of tricky because children, it ends up being the case for most children that they're kind of in multiple different care settings. But before COVID, right around 40% of all children under the age of five attended a daycare center or a family daycare home of some sort. Family daycare homes are childcare providers that are basically offering the care from inside their own home. So 40% of kids go to a formal setting. And then the remaining 60% of children under the age of five are cared for either by their parents or by a relative or a neighbor in some sort of informal arrangement. Yeah, so families where both parents are working and where there's little help available from the community are the ones that are going to have to rely on formal care and centers.
Got it. There appears to be changing norms regarding who is most likely to care for children within the home. Fathers are taking on more and more of that responsibility. But traditionally, this is more likely to have been a mother's primary responsibility. Do we see a relationship between women's labor force participation and the cost of childcare?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look just at averages, it's the case that about 30% of mothers still stay home, where it's about 7% of fathers. So you can already see the differential effect there. Figuring out exactly the effect on female labor force participation is kind of tricky. And there are lots of different results if you look at the existing empirical studies. But most of those studies find that the elasticity of female labor force participation with respect to the price of childcare is somewhere between negative one and zero, with an average of right around 0.37 for the U.S. So that means that, you know, on average, female labor force participation in the U.S. decreases by about 0.37% for a 1% increase in the cost of childcare.
Okay. So just to clarify, that's women's labor force participation aggregate across the United States?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the 0.37 number is from a meta study that's published in the Journal of Economic Surveys that looked at 36 different empirical studies of childcare price elasticity of the female labor force participation rate across different countries even.
And so if a childcare cost increases by about 3%, we will see about 1% of women in the total U.S. population leave the workforce.
Yeah, that's at least the empirical estimate from that meta study, yeah.
Do you know if there's a similar relationship between labor force participation and childcare costs for men? Or is this just something that happens for women?
Yeah, so, you know, the result for women isn't all that high, and the estimates vary pretty dramatically. For men, there isn't, or there doesn't seem to be that strong of a relationship. There aren't that many empirical studies either. But it looks like men are not, at least not in significant numbers, leaving the labor force when they have children.
That is interesting that there's almost a lack of data for men in this regard.
Yeah. And there's actually not that much work empirically in this area overall. And a lot of it is just that it's kind of hard to measure what's going on exactly, because, you know, we don't track what people really end up doing. Parents obviously have to adjust significantly their lifestyles and their work schedules when they have children, but the actual implementation of that kind of varies by family, and there isn't a lot of good information.
Interesting. So future avenues of research for anyone listening out there.
Yeah, even if it's just, you know, asking lots of questions and finding out what different people do.
Absolutely. So diving into your 2014 paper, which is titled Regulations and the Cost of Childcare, you note that childcare providers are one of the lowest wage earning groups in the United States, which I found surprising. I didn't realize this. Is this still true today? Because it's been about 10 years. And what is actually driving the cost of childcare? Why is it so expensive?
Yeah, that's still true. I actually took a look yesterday as I was preparing for this podcast. So the most recent Bureau of Labor Statistics information on me, the average wages of workers in the childcare service industry, is that they earned about $30,000 per year. And that still puts them at the tail end of the earning spectrum. So they report data for, you know, 1,400 industries. And I think childcare and the childcare industry was in the bottom 10 number, right? So 10 out of 1,400 different professions. So yeah, so absolutely in the tail end.
Wait, so it's in the bottom 10 out of 1,400 professions?
Yes, the bottom 10 professions out of 1,400. Yeah, so it's at the tail end, literally. Now, early childcare in particular is a labor-intensive process, right? So if you think about it, everyone who has ever tried to care for children knows this, especially for infants, right? It's difficult to imagine caring for more than one or two at a time. You know, people that have twins are always admired by lots of people for how they handle having twin infants. But, you know, and there are all kinds of like Facebook reels and videos, you know, on Instagram showing what people do that have multiples, like funny videos about babies being carried by fathers along their legs or something like that. I'm not sure that other people see these videos. It might just be me. Yeah, so caring for children is just labor intensive, especially when they're very little, because they just need a lot of attention. And so when you are leaving your child within the care of a childcare center, they still have to kind of replace the labor that you'd be doing at home. So that's in a lot of places, it's regulated to a 1-to-1 ratio where there has to be one provider per infant, or one teacher per infant, one caregiver per infant. But even if it's not regulated like that, it's hard to care for a lot more than 2 or 3 infants at a time. Our youngest daughter, when she started attending daycare, she was about 4 months old. And it was summer at the time. And so I had a really flexible schedule. And so instead of pumping, I would go to the childcare center, which was just like a quarter mile from my office. I would walk over there and just feed her, nurse her in the childcare center. And so I got to watch the infant room in action and watch the teachers care for all the infants. And it's kind of funny because sometimes when one of the babies starts crying because they're hungry, then all the other ones will start crying too. So the teachers always end up finding themselves in a situation where they're feeding one baby with a bottle and everybody else is crying, and they kind of have to just wait until it's their turn. So, you know, it's just a stressful and it really is a labor intensive process.
Got it. So costs are driven by the amount of staff that you would have to hire.
Absolutely. Yeah. Labor cost is just one of the drivers there. And so it turns out that labor cost is probably the most significant factor in determining the price of childcare, especially early on. Now, toddlers are a little bit easier. I think the ratios are usually right around 4 to 6 toddlers per teacher. But it really doesn't get easier and scalable until they're about 3. You know, kids that are 3 years old will not get themselves into super dangerous situations anymore. You don't have to worry about keeping a super close eye. So it's just easier than to scale to like 20 kids per staff or something like that. So wages are definitely one of the bigger drivers of the cost of childcare, because you cannot easily get beyond a ratio of 2 babies per teacher or 4 to 6 toddlers per teacher. But what Devin Gorey and I found in our paper on regulation and the cost of childcare is that the price of care is also influenced importantly by childcare regulation.
What are the most common regulations on childcare, and which would have the largest impact on cost?
Yeah, so, you know, as you can imagine, obviously the goal of regulating childcare, you know, from like a public interest sort of perspective, was always just to ensure quality. So most of the rules kind of target the quality of care. So there's some really basic rules about health and safety. But then beyond those regulations, there are also rules about the quality of care within, you know, the safe environment that's been constructed. So that means rules about the number of teachers per child or teacher education requirements. And those are the ones that really affect the cost of childcare.
When regulation increases costs, this is often what we call potentially having a regressive effect, meaning that the increase in costs due to regulation are impacting lower income individuals more than they're impacting higher income individuals. Do we see that happening with these regulations in childcare?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of tricky with childcare because, you know, regressivity or a regressive effect would be a problem if we could see that people exit the market for childcare when regulation increases. But because there's limited data, and because we haven't been collecting data for very long, and we don't have an easy comparison between low regulated environments and more stringently regulated environments, it's kind of hard to tell. I think a lot of the sorting has already happened, and it turns out that children from low-income backgrounds are less likely to be cared for in regulated settings. So they're more likely to be cared for by relatives or neighbors. But so it's hard to tell whether there is a regressive effect, but it's pretty obvious that only children from higher income households will end up actually in a regulated care setting. So it seems like it's kind of a two-class system, if you will. So there's a regulated environment that children from higher income families attend, and then there is totally unregulated care by relatives and maybe neighbors or their own family members for lower, that is more frequently used by lower income families. So like I said, this might already be a consequence of the high cost of care, which would be a regressive effect, but that's not something I can really say with certainty.
Right. For when a child is just being cared for by a relative or a family member, there's no like regulations that govern that space, completely off the book per se. There are some situations where like at some point that informal care in someone's home can become kind of like a professional daycare center if they have like a large number of kids or if they charge strangers for this. It's not in like a separate building, like on a commercial site, but I've seen before like my mom actually, for instance, growing up, would watch a bunch of our neighbors' children, and she had to register, I think, with the state, and it became slightly more official. So there's like sort of layers to this where it's not like a completely separate commercial building you're bringing children to, but it could be someone's home that has some sort of regulations imposed on it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it varies by state, but the rules are usually something like, you know, if you're caring for more than, you know, two unrelated children, then you're supposed to register as a family daycare home provider with your state. And that means then that you are subject to other rules. You know, mostly the rules that apply to family daycare homes are regarding, so how many children you're caring for in different age groups, but then also health and safety rules about, you know, fencing, access to pools if you have one and stuff like that.
So low-income children are more likely to be cared for by a relative than in a daycare center, which would make sense if the cost of childcare is so prohibitively expensive that an alternative must be found. But it could also just simply be that there's a preference for children to be looked after by someone potentially familiar. Hard to parse that apart in data, I'm assuming. So regulations in childcare are often justified because they aim to increase the quality of the childcare provided, as you said earlier. I'm curious, do we find evidence that supports this or justifies regulation? But first, how do we actually measure quality in childcare settings?
So, you know, quality of childcare is something that's kind of difficult to measure. Unfortunately, you know, it'd be nice if we could just kind of classify this is good, this is not good. but early childhood development research, to the extent that I looked into that more, kind of divides the measures of quality that people use into measures of quality that focus on the process of care and then measures of quality that look at the structure of care. So process measures are things like how a caregiver responds both verbally and non-verbally to like a crying child or a conflict between children or just a question from a child, right? You can imagine people could be kind of standoffish and rude, or they could be happy and supportive. And those things are hard to measure. You kind of have to observe the teacher, ideally without them knowing that you're there and observing them. And then you have to somehow code and record their responses. And it turns out that for a high quality care environment, it's not just verbal responses that matter, but also nonverbal communication. And so, you know, it just gets really tricky to record those sorts of quality measures. But they are the most important measures of a quality care environment. Now, the structural quality of care includes things like how many kids there are per adult, or how many children there are in each group that is being cared for at the same time or in the same, you know, location. Other structural measures are things like the credentials that the teachers have. Those are clearly much easier to observe, right? We can count the number of kids, we can count the number of teachers, we can look at certificates and degrees. So structural quality measures are really easy to record and measure. And so they're also the ones that are usually the target of regulation of the quality of care.
This is despite the fact that it's actually the more process measures that have a bigger impact on the quality of care.
Yeah.
But harder to measure, so we can't act on it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. So to the extent that I'm familiar with this literature on early childhood development, what I was able to parse was that structural measures kind of have a tenuous effect on actual outcomes, and only to the extent that they affect process measures. So, for example, there's a study by David Blau, who's an economist at the University at the Ohio State University, is that what it's called? Yeah. he kind of looked at the different structural measures and looked and tried to figure out which ones actually had an effect on outcomes for children. And what he found was that out of the structural measures, like group size and staff ratios, the one that seemed to matter for the quality of care is only whether or not the teacher had or taken a class on early childhood education in the last 12 months. And so, you know, if somebody is actually currently aware and attuned to thinking about how to interact with children in a constructive way, because they're taking a class on it literally within the last 12 months, then that will have an effect on their interactions with the children such that the quality of care is just better. But the other structural measures, like the group size limits and the staff-child ratios, those didn't seem to affect quality and outcomes very much at all. So at the end of the day, even though regulation tries to improve quality, all it can really do is to improve the structure of the care environment.
Interesting. So regulations surrounding educational requirements for staff actually seems to have the biggest impact in terms of quality, but mostly because it's trying to address more of that process measures. It'd be extremely difficult to try to craft policy over how a caregiver responds to a crying child or how they solve conflict or their attitude when they're watching children. But actually, this is what matters most, which is kind of interesting. Given your expertise in understanding the unintended consequences of regulation, are there any in the market for childcare, and what are they?
So there's another study here by David Blau that's relevant, where he looked at these different rules and how they affected quality and also cost. And he found that, unfortunately, some of these regulations of structural measures have the unintended consequence of suppressing staff wages and increasing staff turnover rates in childcare centers. Now, you know, I was saying that procedural measures of quality, like how a staff member interacts with or a childcare provider interacts with the children, matter most for a quality environment. And it turns out that turnover rates, you know, frequently changing teachers or teachers moving on to different jobs, is also a problem for childcare quality, just because, you know, the children have a trust relationship with the teachers. And so if the teacher changes, that means they have to build a new relationship. And so that's difficult. So turnover is a problem.
Could you just elaborate a little bit more on how wages are suppressed because of these regulations?
Yeah. So because regulation has usually focused on prescribing like a ratio of staff per children or group size limits, childcare centers have kind of found themselves unable to take advantage of economies of scale, right? So if you have to have one teacher for every 10 toddlers that you're watching, then that means that the cost of caring for those 10 toddlers has to cover the teacher's wage, right? So what they have done to reduce cost, because they can't increase the number of children a teacher cares for, is to limit, you know, raises for their teachers, essentially, right? So suppressing wages, kind of keeping the cost of wages low, means that childcare centers can provide childcare at lower prices because they can't do it by scaling up and having a teacher care for more kids.
So turning a bit more recently to the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a lot of fear that when childcare centers closed down, that the burden of childcare would fall primarily to women and moms, and that this would result in a particularly strong negative impact on women's labor force participation rates. Did we actually see this happen?
Yeah, so there were lots of fears, but the actual impact on labor force participation seems to have been not on, the differential seems to have been not on men versus women, but the difference, the largest difference seems to have been on less educated versus more educated. And people were talking about this too during the pandemic, right? Less educated people who worked in the service industry, including like restaurants and hairdressers and stuff like that, they didn't have an option of working from home. So they were let go. They lost their jobs early on in the pandemic during the lockdowns. More highly educated people could work from home and they didn't have to quit their jobs, even when they had to care for their kids at the same time, or, you know, elderly relatives or something like this. Claudia Golden actually has a great NBER working paper on this topic from 2022. The title of that paper is Understanding the Economic Impact of COVID-19 on Women. And what she says is that it turns out that the effect on female labor force participation really depends on your comparison, right? So if you are trying to look on the comparison between men and women, female labor force participation had kind of been on a plateau since the 1990s at roughly 75%. So 75% of women were participating in the labor force, of working age women. But it had been flat since the 1990s. And then right before COVID, there was kind of a rally up a little bit. So more women joined the labor force. And so if you look at right before COVID, like say, you know, February 2020 and compare female labor force participation in February 2020 to February 2021, then yes, you see a decrease in female labor force participation. But Golden kind of argues that that's a little bit misleading. So looking at the longer run, it seems like female labor force participation really hasn't been affected much. And you see this in more recent studies too. There's one by the St. Louis Fed, I think, that recently looked at female labor force participation of mothers and women that aren't mothers, and then also fathers and men who aren't fathers. And it looks like the recovery after COVID is already complete. People are, labor force participation is back to where it was before and maybe even higher.
Oh, wow. That's actually like really interesting. It just kind of bounced back. Wasn't a permanent change, it looks like. So what was the initial policy response during the pandemic on childcare centers?
Yeah. So initially, you know, you'll remember there were all these distancing requirements that came into effect early on in the pandemic during the lockdowns. So the initial effect of the pandemic on childcare centers was through those distancing requirements, which stipulated smaller class sizes and you know, social distance. That put a lot of stress on childcare centers because a feature of how childcare centers kind of distribute the cost of care. So like I was mentioning this earlier, right? Early on, for infants, the ratio of teachers to children has to be pretty much 1-to-1 or close to it, right? Maybe one teacher can care for up to 3 to 4 infants, but that's it. As the kids get older, it gets easier, so then they can care for more kids. And so that means that a lot of the time, childcare centers will subsidize their infant rooms with their preschool rooms. In a preschool room, they can have, you know, maybe 20 kids per teacher. So that means they can actually earn a little bit more money on that side of their operation and funnel it towards the more expensive to care for infant rooms. Now, the distancing requirements during COVID made this kind of upset this scheme significantly because they reduced the number of pre-K kids or, you know, preschool kids or toddlers that were allowed to be in the same group and with the same teacher because childcare centers have only so much space, right? And so that meant that all of a sudden, kind of the side of their business model that was earning them money and could be used to subsidize the other end was no longer making money for them. So that meant that a lot of centers either closed or, you know, had to be subsidized in some way to stay open. Now at the macro level, the increases in the cost of childcare above inflation are kind of how you see this, right? So both in 2020 and 2021, there were systematic closures, but then also the cost of care that was still available increased by about 5% in both of those years. The number of centers that kind of existed went down by 4%. So about 4% of the centers closed between 2019 and 2020, and about 7% of family daycare homes closed.
And were there also secondary responses after childcare centers closed down?
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, data on this is limited, but we have lots of narrative and anecdotal evidence, right, that people started experimenting with alternative forms of care. You know, more people started hiring nannies, for example, right? Like I can speak from my own experience. We had two kids in daycare when COVID hit. And so my husband and I both were going to go back to teaching in the fall of 2020, and we were really worried that our childcare center would close for extended periods of time whenever they had to, you know, close because somebody had tested positive or something like that. You know, childcare centers would just close down for, you know, like a couple of weeks whenever somebody had tested positive. And so what we did is we hired a nanny, right? Because we thought, okay, so if we have a nanny, then at least we're contained to our own family. And if anybody tests positive in our own family, then we'll shut down, but we're not subject to having to shut down because other people tested positive and we're actually okay. We just wanted to have kind of a greater ability to predict, you know, when we would have childcare and when we wouldn't. So we got an in-home nanny. Other people I know like grouped up and had childcare pods and stuff like that, just like they did for, you know, K through eight sort of education. People kind of came up with their own solutions. Now, Claudia Golden argues in her NBER paper that I already mentioned that a lot of what happened during COVID is that mothers who were employed full-time and working remotely just maintained full-time jobs while also caring for their children, and that the result of that was an increase in the level of stress of the mothers.
It's easily imaginable. So if you could wave a magic wand and go back in time with the benefit of hindsight, what would have been the best or a better policy response during the pandemic?
I think that given what we know about the actual mortality rates associated with COVID, especially for kids, by age group, I think it would have been wise to kind of exclude childcare centers from the distancing requirements, elementary schools too, I would say. But that's just me, right? Like my dream sort of experimentation at the time would have been like, rather than distancing the kids, just, you know, instead of distancing the kids, just kind of isolate older or vulnerable caregivers, take them out of school settings if you want, and maybe reduce the staff child ratios, right? Make it so that children can be in larger groups with each other with less supervision, if that's what we needed. Another thing I think that might have been a great experiment would have been to allow childcare centers and elementary schools to have more outdoor play, right? So my kids, our oldest daughter was in first grade during the pandemic, and they ended up going back in the fall of 2020, but they all had plexiglass on their desks and had to wear masks all day. And I thought that was silly, given what we already knew about kids transmitting and also the risks associated with the kids getting the virus. So I would have preferred experimentation with more outdoor free play and stuff like that. I think that what we know now in terms of the effect of screen time and social media on adolescents, especially from Jonathan Haidt's work, you know, in his recent book on the Anxious Generation and stuff like that, we know that more screen time, which is what we did during COVID, right, and access to social media is actually detrimental for kids and adolescents. And what they really need is more free play with their peers to develop socially and emotionally. So playing with each other. And so I think COVID would have been a great time to experiment with that. So give them more recess, less adult supervision, especially if you're worried about putting them into a classroom with vulnerable adults. That's not what happened, unfortunately.
Right. So what, in your opinion, of course, is the most lasting impact of the pandemic on the market for childcare?
Yeah, it's hard to say from a macro perspective what's changed. I'm getting the sense that less has changed than I would have liked. There are no good statistics available yet on how children under the age of five are being cared for since the pandemic. But observationally, I think it seems that one big effect of the pandemic was that childcare centers that were systematically being cross-subsidized because they were affiliated with some other organization ended up closing up shop. So our childcare center that our kids attended was associated with the university, and the university sold it off in December of 2020. And the same happened to another university childcare center here that's in Omaha here at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. I think they closed completely during the pandemic. Independent centers that were just private without any sort of affiliation made it through the pandemic largely intact. Some of that was because there were also significant subsidies from the federal government, especially for children of essential workers like healthcare people. We do know that at the national level, there are more childcare centers in operation today, although that might still be an effect of that large inflow of extra subsidies. But the trend for family daycare homes is kind of down and has been down for a long time. The pandemic kind of accelerated a little bit, but it's just steady down.
So there were subsidies given out during the COVID-19 pandemic to childcare centers, and those are still continuing to this time?
So most of the subsidies ran out in the fall of 2023. Yeah, there were actually a significant chunk of the federal government's COVID spending was on childcare, was I think $34 billion. But it all went through the existing structure of the child care development block grants and stuff like that. So the states were kind of left to figuring out how they would use the money in different states to the different things. Mostly what happened is that childcare for essential workers was free, and then staff wages were kind of get increased through bonuses and stuff like that. So some of that ran out in 2023. I think some of it will run out this fall, but then that's pretty much it. So the states are kind of having to reevaluate. And I think that's also why there's a big push to continue the federal subsidies now.
What are your opinion on subsidies for child care centers? It's a really popular proposal. We hear about it all the time that we should potentially have bigger subsidies or even potentially government-sponsored daycare centers. Do you think this is a worthwhile policy solution to increase affordability for childcare?
It depends on what the goal is, right? So I'm not the biggest fan of subsidies generally, but I think it kind of depends. So clearly, if the intention of a subsidy is to reduce the cost of raising children and encourage families to have more kids, then we kind of already know that doesn't really work, right? So if there's like a longer run goal of trying to increase fertility, that doesn't seem to be really related to how many subsidies you give to people. So I'm not sure that subsidies would make a huge difference there. If the intention is just to relieve the financial strain on low-income families, then I think there are already programs in place like Head Start and Early Head Start that kind of offer some options for those families. Again, though, there are problems with those programs with, accessibility and you know, their wait lists and stuff like that. Now, I think if the goal is to reduce the cost of childcare while still providing higher quality care, then I would ultimately say the first step should be to remove regulation that's excessive, or at least reconsider the way that we're currently regulating childcare and see if that would have an effect on the cost, right? So can we maybe increase group sizes or reduce the number of staff per child for older age groups? You know, they're already pretty high at something like 20 in most states, but maybe it's okay for a teacher to care for 30 kids, you know, that are, you know, two and above, because the kids can play by themselves pretty well. So I think experimenting with those sorts of things would be kind of the first step that I would propose, just because there is an effect on cost. That's what we show in the paper with Devin Gorey. But I would start there.
And what, in your opinion, would be the best way to actually improve quality in addition to affordability?
Yeah. So, you know, like we were talking about, I would say to increase quality, since you're trying to focus on the actual process of how the caregivers interact with the children, I would say maybe get rid of some of the education requirements for teachers in terms of like having associate's degrees or having even full college degrees, and instead just require some sort of continuous education in early childhood development, right? Because that seems to actually have an effect. So it's okay for somebody with a high school diploma to be a lead teacher in an infant room. If they like caring for children, let's just make sure that they take like a concurrent class, you know, every year in early childhood development, so they kind of are just aware of what it means to interact with a child in a way that's constructive.
And if someone was interested in diving deeper into this research or broadly the regressive effects of regulation, what would you recommend in terms of further readings or other scholars that are in this space?
Yeah, so I mentioned David Blau earlier on. He did a lot of work on economics and regulation of childcare centers. That's really interesting. His work's a little bit older now, and he's emeritus already, but it's still just really good work. If you're interested in the regressive effects of regulation more broadly, and not just childcare, Then there's a special issue of the Public Choice Journal from 2018 that combines a lot of, I think, really interesting papers on the topic, you know, looking at the effect of regulation on wages across different industries and the effect of regulation on prices of consumables and things like that. So if you're interested in that, I would recommend looking at this special issue of the Public Choice Journal. If you're interested in fertility and the choices surrounding having children more broadly, then I think Catherine Pekalik's recent book, Hannah's Children, is really an excellent read. I've been recommending it to everyone I know that's in childbearing age or close to childbearing age. I think it's just an awesome book to kind of think through what it means to have children and to care for them for women. I have a book review on her book coming out in the Independent Review and in the upcoming issue of the Independent Review. If you just want to take a peek. And then on that same topic of fertility and how the fertility gap is affected, Clara Jace at the University of Mississippi and Anna Claire Flowers, who's a GMU PhD student, are doing some really interesting work that is worth following and looking at, I think.
Got it. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Thomas, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Jessica. It was lovely. I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.